the irony of doing some being a guy who does technology research is that I have a record collection and I still write things down with a pen, and I'm not very good with technology sometimes. My talk is definitely less sexy than talking about Tinder hookups, but hopefully it will still be useful to all of you. So this morning what I'm going to talk about is less how people are using technology and more how it is that we may use technology to improve our implementation science efforts. So I also have no disclosures I need to make. So I don't see a lot of homeless youth folks that I know in the audience, so I'll spend a little time talking about the domain really here. So there's about 1.6 million homeless youth every year in the United States, and their HIV rates are very alarming. Unfortunately, the prevalence rates come from fairly old studies that were conducted in the late 90s. No one's really updated this work in a very, very long time. But the prevalence rates have been shown to be as high as 11% in some cities. And unfortunately, there's a very small number of evidence-based interventions that have been developed for homeless youth, despite the fact that they have such a high risk for HIV infection. So one potentially promising piece of implementation research that we could get into would be working on peer-based prevention interventions for homeless youth. Part of this is because homeless youth are so disconnected from adults and traditional service providers, so using themselves to connect to their peers seems like a very potentially effective way of doing HIV prevention. And in fact, there's been a fair number of researchers, including myself, who've written on the potential for using these sorts of methods. And internationally, as well as domestically, a lot of populations, like young men that have sex with men, as well as many other populations, have successfully implemented these peer-based strategies. So really the question with homeless youth is this going to work? And if it is going to work, how can we make it work potentially as effectively as possible? And this isn't just a academic question. There's been a lot of HIV peer-led interventions that have not been quite so effective. Particularly, there was a big NIH multi-site trial that was conducted about 10 years ago that didn't have very promising results. And so there's been some discussion amongst implementation science thinking folks around these peer-led models about sort of what went wrong and how might we do this better, since it does work sometimes and it doesn't work others. And John Schneider at the University of Chicago this last year wrote an article that I thought was really compelling, where he makes the point that perhaps one of the main problems that we have going on in these interventions is that we're not always picking our peer leaders very well, because really the peer leader model is based on selecting a small number of people that you train about HIV prevention issues, who are then going to disseminate those messages around testing and condom use to other folks within their networks. So the issue of who you pick is a critical one. And oftentimes what happens is that people are picked basically through convenience. Most community-based organizations and non-governmental organizations internationally really just rely on volunteers and or people who are selected by those agencies as sort of good candidates, right? As oftentimes pro-social people, people who are invested in HIV prevention, people who are formerly part of a risk population. So for example, Carlack in Baltimore does a lot of work with injection drug users, and he primarily uses his peer leaders are former injection drug users who want to go out into the community and do this work. And in fact, when I did a pilot test with homeless youth of a peer-led intervention back in 2009, I also did this typical method. So I was working with young people who were helping me develop the content for the program, as well as young people who were identified by the agency that I was working with as folks who they thought would be good as peer leaders. And so it was really based on sort of implicit knowledge of the community that we are serving and the people who are serving that community, but not really something more systematic. Now, Tom Valenti at USC has also published recently, although less recently, on some of these ideas about how one might use network methods in order to improve this implementation efforts. And he was really talking about different sorts of network measurements that you might use to pick people who would be the most efficient and therefore potentially effective peer leaders in your population. So some of the things that he talks about are issues that we might want to think about is degree centrality or betweenness. These are two, I'll give you two brief network concepts just to give you a sense of where we're going here. Degree centrality is a really simple measure in a network So essentially, once you capture a network population, you then figure out how many people is every person in that population connected to. And so degree centrality really just simply refers to the count, the number of people. So one person has 5 friends, another person has 10 friends. A person with 10 friends is more central than a person with 5 friends. Betweenness centrality is the idea that some people bridge between other people. So people with a high betweenness centrality sit between many sets of other pairs of people. And so instead of looking for the people who themselves have the most connections, you're looking for the people that bridge the most connections. So these are two ways of thinking about networks that people have started to think about might improve our HIV prevention implementation. Particularly Schneider, in this article that I referenced just a minute ago, thinks that these betweenness folks might be the way to go. So if you have a large population that has perhaps hundreds of people that you're trying to target at one time, you don't necessarily want to be picking the people who just sit at the middle of that group, but you want to find the people that are really the interstitial bridging folks and train them because they'll have the most reach. Okay, so why am I talking about artificial intelligence then? Well, for one thing, I need to start by saying, what is artificial intelligence? I think we have a lot of media representations of artificial intelligence being, you know, computers that think are going to try to take over the world or kill you in your sleep or something like this. And obviously, that's not what we're talking about. Really, what we're talking about here is creating computer programs that can make very sophisticated decisions for us when we have a lot of complexity, and particularly when we have a lot of uncertainty. And so I've been working with a group of computer scientists at the School of Engineering at USC who do work in artificial intelligence, particularly around strategy problems. So for example, some of the work that they've done before they started working with us was they were looking at airport security and how you might deploy people to protect a region around an airport, given that you may not know where a terrorist threat's going to come from and you have a limited number of resources, and how do you deploy those people effectively. So they're interested in strategy games, basically. And so when we met with them, when we were talking about HIV prevention and the implementation of these peer leader programs, to them this struck them as a strategy problem. Essentially, who do we pick so that we have the most reach in the population? And one of the things that they quickly started to talk to us about was the fact that these artificial intelligence programs could give us an answer that might be better than what I was just describing by degree or betweenness centrality. The problem with degree and betweenness centrality is that, well, a couple of things in the context of homeless youth. One, you basically have to know what the network looks like. And for the case of homeless youth, this is actually a huge problem. You know, I think I'm probably most well known for the work that I do on the networks of homeless youth, and I think the thing that I can share with you from that work more than anything else is how cumbersome and complex and messy that work is. And essentially what drives that is that homeless youth themselves are very transient. They come onto the streets for a few days, they get off the streets and go back to a safe space for a few days, they get arrested, they get into transitional living programs, and moreover, even if they're stably on the streets for a long period of time, the people that they're friends with today, they may have a huge falling out with over drugs, over who didn't help somebody get into a squat for the night. Boyfriends and girlfriends break up and split little groups of young people who've been helping one another out. So the people who are friends today oftentimes are not friends a week later. And what we found when we were doing this work a few years ago was that it took us about a month to go and sample an entire population of about 200 to 300 youth that were centered around specific neighborhoods. And by the time we were done collecting that data, it then took us another couple of months to piece together all the intricacies of how those networks were created. So by the time we actually knew what the network looked like, it was about 4 months later, and we were quite certain at that point that the network didn't look anything like it did at the time anymore. So really, trying to do an implementation science project where you're picking very strategically in this really fluid context gets to be really messy. So one of the things that the artificial intelligence program can do for us is it can try to model the uncertainty and say, well, look, this tie exists right now, but it may disappear. This tie that doesn't exist now may appear. And the other piece of it that's really interesting here is that something like degree centrality, not only is it based on knowing what the network looks like, but at any one given time, once you decide this is what the network looks like, it's going to pick the 15% of people who share, who have the highest number of ties. And it's not necessarily going to be able to adjudicate between, well, perhaps now degree centrality is the best way to go, but then we've already picked a bunch of people who are toward the core of the network. Maybe it would be better if we picked somebody who is a bridger later in the implementation of this of the project. So you're kind of stuck with a solution, whereas artificial intelligence can allow us to be more flexible. So what they created for us, and this is where it starts to get a bit above my skill set. My joke is that I know I took enough math in college that I'm dangerous. So I understand what they're doing, but I couldn't do it. What they've done is they've used what's referred to as a partially observable Markov decision process. And so this is a pretty well-established group of complicated decision rules that computer scientists are very interested in. Game theorists like these things a lot. And essentially, intuitively, what it does is it models a situation where an agent, in this case the agent is going to be the intervention team, is going to be picking a solution at any given time based on essentially trying to maximize whatever you've decided are the long-term rewards in this situation. So in our case, what we want to do is we want to pick people that are going to reach the most people. And what this can do is that, especially if you're deploying an intervention as we do in the real world when we're doing popular opinion leader models, where you train a few people, then you train a few more people, and you train a few more people, because you can't train 20% of a population all at one shot, typically. What we can do is we can pick who seems to be the best people at the time, gather some more information, see how maybe the network has shifted in the time since we started, then deploy another set of decisions. And the other thing that this does, and here's, I think I'm going to use this slide. I think this is a better way of representing this. Essentially, the program works in these four steps, or three steps rather. First, what it does is it samples the uncertain, what we refer to as edges. Those are the ties in a network. So essentially, we're going to make a guess at, to the best of our knowledge, this is what the network we think looks like at this moment in time. And then we're going to try to determine through a series of sequential steps who might be the best next person to pick to be a peer leader. So if we pick this person, they could influence these three people who could potentially influence then those nine people. Or if we pick this person who can influence these four people, who's then connected to another only three people, maybe that's not as good of a decision. And then the last piece of it is that we vote for the best action. And the reason that this is important is that when you are looking at a network space where you have several hundred people, there are actually several hundreds of, there's actually a couple hundred thousand, or actually, what is it? There's tens of thousands of ties that possibly could exist in that network space, which therefore means that there quickly becomes trillions of possible actions that you could pick that are these contingent actions. So what we need is we need a very clever artificial intelligence program that can be able to, that can pick between these actions for us. And so this is one of the ways that they've been talking about this. So what you see here in this graph is really looking at the uncertainty space here. So in the right-hand network, there's two ties that have check marks that the left-hand network doesn't have, and that's because when you're thinking about action 1 versus potential action 45, in action 1, those ties don't exist, but in action 45, you're making the assumption that, well, perhaps A is connected to B and E is connected to F. And so think about this sprawling out over hundreds and hundreds of youth with tens of thousands of possible connections that they could have. So when they actually looked at our, I didn't want that to happen. Okay. When we looked at the two real-world networks that we gave them, one we had collected in Venice Beach and the other we had collected in Hollywood, what we did was they compared a couple of versions of their program, so CINET-S and CINET-W, and the distinction between those two is not so critical at this point, but DC is degree centrality. So when we first started looking at this, what we thought about was, how much better, how much faster can we get to people if we are going to use this artificial intelligence program versus a simple static decision rule like degree centrality, the most popular people? And what we found was that particularly the latter version of CINET that they had developed, this CINET-W, that it was about 60% more efficient in terms of its reach. So we could get to a lot more people than just by picking the popular people. So what I want to show you is why does that work? And I've kind of alluded to this already, but so this is essentially how CINET works. early on in its decision tree, it's going to pick the people who are central because they have the most ties. So obviously the people with the most ties are going to have, instead of having only two people they could reach, they each have 10 people they could reach. But then as the program proceeds, it starts picking people in various regions that haven't been reached yet. So you can see how early on we're toward the middle of this diagram. Then we start picking people that are in these sort of more peripheral spaces where there hadn't been action happening yet. So after we had worked on that iteration of this, the John Schneider article came out where he was arguing for the importance of these bridging actors. So we thought what we really wanted to do was compare the bridging actors hypothesis with the centrality hypothesis, as well as then we wanted to look at how well would have my community-based picks been. So in this diagram, what you get is you get the green dots were actually my community-based picks. And so the thing, I don't know if you can see it so well, so I'm going to run over.
These three people were three of my community picks, right? I mean, they were great kids, they were really pro-social, they were really engaged in developing this program with me, but they weren't really connected to many people at all, right?
And so, not surprisingly, if you look here at our flow rate, the real network is the loser here, right? So the real network, you know, we really didn't have a whole lot of reach. I mean, I picked young people that everybody thought would be great peer leaders, but they don't have a lot of reach when we run our simulation experiments, testing out the assumptions of this model. In comparison, betweenness and degree centrality both do about the same in this particular network, and the psi net is centrality and degree betweenness are both about twice as good as my picks were, whereas the psi net's about three times better, and it's about half again as good as the degree centrality and betweenness. So I think I'm just about down to a minute or so. So where are we now with this? We're just struggling through our IRB right now to go and do a pilot test of this right now. And really, to me, sort of the two issues that really seem to be most relevant at this point in terms of testing this in the real world are, one, will homeless youth, who are a fairly paranoid group of young people who've been treated very badly by a lot of systems of care, will they actually want to do something where a computer program that's an artificial intelligence computer program selects who's going to get to be a peer leader? They're oftentimes very concerned with issues of justice and such things, and also the idea that a computer program's picking them out may not fly so well with them, although it seems like they're pretty okay with it, I think, but we'll find out. And then more importantly is, will the youth who the program picks actually want to do this? I mean, this is one of the problems. I mean, we can talk about how this would make us far more structurally efficient and we can get to a much larger space in the network by picking these folks through these simulation experiments. But the issue is, you know, will those young people actually want to do it, or are the young people who are going to want to be involved in these sorts of programs with adults like me going to end up being my three green dots over there that are off in space? And I fear that sometimes what makes one a pro-social homeless youth is a lack of engagement with the larger network of, you know, high-risk-taking homeless youth. And so the very thing that would make you a good peer leader in terms of your connection to your peers is going to be essentially a barrier to you wanting to be engaged with an adult like me who's going to be doing HIV prevention programming. And likewise, the young people who want to be involved with adults tend to be relatively distanced from the rest of that network, as in some ways as a survival strategy. So that to me is really the most important question here. And with that, I will thank my colleagues, particularly Amelia Yadav and Milan Tambe, who are at the USC Viterbi School of Engineering, who did all the hard work in programming, and then my colleagues at Social Work, including Robin Petering, who's here in the audience, and also Heather Carmichael at my friend's place, which is the Homeless Youth Agency, where we did the work from the 2009 pilot and who's also been helping us think through this new project. So thanks a lot.
If you presented or submitted an abstract
Sure. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, part of how I've done it is that I've been very lucky that USC, the School of Social Work, is not attached to our medical campus, and it's instead attached to our larger sort of, social science. It's viewed as part of the social science campuses, and they are a much more collaborative IRB, and I've actually spent a lot of time working with them around issues of homeless youth. And in fact, I can get a waiver of parental consent for minors that there's actually a checkbox that says, because these are endangered youth who don't have good parental supervision, such as neglected, abused, homeless children. And that actually box didn't exist 6 years ago when I started at USC, and I spent so much time working with them around these ethics issues. And so what I'm trying to say is that there's a political and educational component of working with IRBs that I think is necessary in order to work with these really highly vulnerable populations. And I think that it's a fair amount of work, but it's worth, the effort. So yeah, that, sure, if it's going on, I think it's probably a great idea.
Do I have one more question?
This is really bad.
Right.
That they were consistent in their message and the more popular ones went with that, the cheaper penetration and those kinds of head down the message.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we've observed in the data that we collected on these networks was that the young people who are more at the core of these networks tend to be more engaged in violence. They tend to be more, there's less condom use, there's more chronic marijuana use, there's more methamphetamine abuse. I mean, there's a lot of sort of issues that those most popular young people have. I think part of what happens, and this is just sort of the way that norms work, is that in order to be very, very popular, you have to essentially be a paragon of that cultural group. And this is homeless youth are my population. I love them. I always, these are some of my favorite people in the world, but they're fairly antisocial. And so, what makes you cool as a homeless youth is being tough and being, not necessarily so positive all the time in the ways that we would want. So yeah, their messaging is kind of all over the place because it's not directed at trying to be a consistent positive health message. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Thank you so much.